Welcome to the Ages of Rock podcast with your hosts, Bill Algie, Dennis Talbot, and Alan Tate. We are three guys who have one thing in common, a love of rock and roll. Our goal is to talk about all things rock. We hope you find this show intriguing, funny, and occasionally highly opinionated. Enjoy.
Hey, welcome to the latest edition of the Ages of Rock podcast. I am one of your hosts, Mr. Dennis Talbot. I'm here with Bill Algie and Mr. Bearded Man.
My real name is Nigel Jameson.
Is Nigel Jameson.
Well, wait, how come you were Mr. Dennis Talbot and you were Mr. Bearded Man and I was just Bill Algie?
Alan Tate.
The tater.
He just keeps digging deeper and deeper.
I'm having fun. Beard jokes are fun. Anyway,
did I say what episode
this is? This is episode 182. God, can you believe that shit?
182. No, I can't believe you put up with your shit this
18
long.
18 episodes until we have hit number 200.
Wow, we got to find a very special guest, Gene.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be something?
That would be something.
It would be nice. We gotta find somebody big for that. And not weight-wise. We could get Vince Neil.
We could put the writer, hey, we'll take you to the Chinese buffet.
How about we get sure Vince Neil and Tommy Lee on here and let them argue?
Okay. So anyway, but we do have a guest tonight. We have Kyle Kruger from... He is the person that put together the Here I Go Again DVD or movie or however you want to say it. And it's a very interesting DVD if you can get it and Amazon Prime. You can buy it from their website for a short period of time, which you'll find out here later. But they do have some stuff that they'll sell just for a short time later. But anyway, great guy. It was a fun conversation. Got a little more in depth of the movie.
Let me interject real quick here. About halfway through the interview, you'll notice the sound of our guest's microphone change because we had a little technical difficulty. So he switched some equipment out, and it's the sound difference is totally different.
So if you start listening to the interview and his voice kind of goes in and out, bear with it because it does halfway through it goes back to normal. It was just a matter of on his end being hardwired in. Anyway, as far as being hardwired, we got a lot of stuff coming. We got stuff coming up. We did some stuff while we were gone from the last time. Where do we want to start? I got a couple new records.
I didn't buy any records.
All right.
Are you want to do record me?
All right. I got just a couple.
Me too.
All right. You want to go first?
I have just a couple.
Okay.
Oh, shit. I'm not going through all of them.
A couple inches of a pile. They're still doing real fast.
I'm pretty sure that's at least 6 inches.
All right.
That's what she said.
Yeah. It's one of those records, the one you're going to be bringing me.
I wouldn't count yours in my stack, you dumbass. But I'm just going to highlight a few.
There you go.
The good I'm ones. Kind of there excited about. So there you go. You guys can go ahead, go with yours. I'm going to sort through here.
Oh, so I got you. So I only picked up two today, and then I got one. Actually, I'll show this one first. My father-in-law brought me over two record. I guess it's the first Chicago. I'm not for sure.
Yeah,
I haven't really did research on it.
Yep.
So yeah, this is he brought this over and said, "Hey, I know you like records. I went through my thing. This is kind of what he has a lot of singer songwriter folk type stuff, but this is one he thought I would like. So it's cool. I'm gonna clean it up a little bit. I went up to my favorite place today and I got this Frampton's first album. This is really good. I got this for $6. It's got Show Me the Way, Baby, I Love Your Way, Penny for Your Thoughts, I'll Give You Money.
Those
great album. Can't wait
cuts,
to listen
correct?
To exactly, because the only thing I've ever heard is, well, actually, this was out in 74, or 75, 76 is when Frampton Comes Alive came out. So
I don't think
was
that's this, the first one, then, is it?
It's not the first one, but it's pre...
Well, you said it's the first one. It ain't the first one.
It's the first one that came up on Spotify. So I didn't
first
do
one that came out before the one that
I got tonight. I got it tonight. But I got another good one here. Billy Joel, The Stranger.
Nah.
And I got this for $8. What do you mean, nah?
Nah.
Moving Out, The Stranger, Just the Way You Are, Scenes from an Italian Restaurant in Vienna. Billy Joel's always a woman. Oh, my God.
Billy Joel's
and
a dickhead.
He's a dickhead. But he's got, and here, once again, Full City Boutique. This is
that's
one of those
cool.
Old,
that's so, cool.
Yeah, I like finding the ones from the old Full City Boutique. And people that are not that aren't from Evansville don't know what it was. It was a really cool record kind of head shop, record store downtown. This guy named Fultz was his last name. He was really into these wood carvings and doing wood kind of stuff. And this place was really neat. I mean, it was, yeah. And that's the same way it was whenever that other place that they ended up fat, was it Good Time Eddie's or Good Time Freddy's or whatever hell it was? He built that place Funkies. Too, all this wood stuff. No, Funky's was one of them, but then there was a one on the east side that's now a CVS. They had Elliott Steakhouse for a long time. Remember Elliott Steakhouse? Where you cooked your own steak?
You're talking a bunch of stuff that predates my time here.
All right.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you were. Okay, so show us some of your good stuff.
So moving right along.
And make sure to save them.
So keeping with the theme.
There you go.
Alive. I also got I'm In You, by the way, which came after this record, by the way, just so you know.
Okay.
Not before. At least I don't think it did. This is a record club version. Cool. You guys are going to be shocked, but I picked this up because I got it for nothing.
I
got it for very little, actually, this because I think this is a really... Yeah, so this is a really cool cover, and my dad actually has a surfboard that has this painting on it.
Okay, cool. What's the name of the album?
Steve Miller Band, Book of Dreams. Yeah, so it's got Jet Airliner and...
it's a good album.
Jungle Love, and it'll probably never be played. Anyway. Michael Jackson Thriller.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's pretty cool.
There you go.
This is pretty cool too. Elton John Greatest Hits.
I like that one.
This is the 1974 version.
Right.
And it's the original Greatest Hits version. This record was like on Discogs for $15.
Yeah, there's a Greatest Hits 1 and a Greatest Hits 2.
Well, there's a Greatest Hits. There's two different versions of this.
Are there, okay,
this is the original, and there's one of them looks like he's playing golf. That's
Greatest Hits 2.
Was that Greatest Hits 2?
That's Greatest Hits 2.
And then they also had some jazz stuff, so I got a Al Hurt record. Cool. Just because I thought it was cool, and I wanted to just check it out. So, and I got the one I thought that was titled The Coolest, so it says
Sugar
it's called Sugar Lips. So, and then I've got a bunch of other ones, but it's like just some random stuff, but...
It was funny. Bill calls me last night. He goes, I'm at a friend's house. He's selling some records. Here's what he's got. So he was like going, I got it.
Would have been funny yesterday?
If
he called, if you'd have handed me the phone and let me answer it.
We were at band practice.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
That would have been just, Bill would have been like, oh, sorry, I meant to call Dennis. And then I'd have answered.
But there was one record that he had that I wanted, and I'll show it next week whenever I get it from. And I will be bringing you that album this on Saturday when we see you.
As we segue into the next segment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What we're doing this Saturday.
Well, this Friday, for me, I am picking up the band Survivor.
Oh, I heard them.
They're doing the free concert here in Columbus on Saturday. Free hospice concerts, a fundraiser for hospice, the biggest fundraiser they do all year. And I'm picking them up at the airport on Friday. I got to drive them a little bit on Saturday morning and then take them back to the airport on Sunday. But, I can't be there on Saturday night because we have plans to see
Kiss.
For the third time this year.
Yep. Third time for me too.
I think I've seen them three times in 1 year. See them three times, but not three times.
But I am. This will be probably, unless they come to Evansville, this will probably be my last show. But this will be my son's first show. So it'll be kind of a neat neat experience. I'm taking my son Max with us, or with me, and because Kelly's
so
already
for
seen
Max,
them
it
in Nashville.
Will be the beginning of the end of the road.
Exactly. He was like going, "Do we have to stand up all night?" I'm like going, "Yeah, we're gonna be standing. We're gonna be we're in the lawn."
Yeah, I'm taking Alex. So it'll be his fourth show.
Cool.
Maybe fourth show. Yeah, for me, if it's I'd like to go to the very last show if it's someplace where I can get to, but otherwise this might be the last unless they come to Evansville.
So we will be, for everybody that wants to know and is going to be at that, who listens to this and is going to be at that concert in Indianapolis at Ruhoff. I got it right this time, but I call it Deer Creek. This Saturday night, we are going to be across the way from the back entrance in the Sleepy Bear campground around 4 o'clock Eastern time, because Indianapolis is ahead of us. And we're going to be meeting up with a bunch of other people who listen to the show and people that we know. So if you're listening to this and going to be there, come over to the Sleepy Bear and park there. It costs $20, but you're going to get out of the concert before anybody gets out of the concert. And you'll be on the road and be on the south side of Indianapolis, if you're like me, before people are getting out of the parking lot. It's worth that $20. It's the best kept secret in Indianapolis, to be honest. So,
yep.
Well, it's not a secret now.
It's not
now.
A secret
Thanks,
now.
Dennis.
It is.
Alan, who are you going with?
I am going with three of my favorite people. Me, myself,
and
I.
Me, myself, and I. There you go.
I am going
by
myself.
You're driving up by yourself?
Actually, that's not true. I am not going by myself. My friend Jeff, who lives in Speedway, Indiana, had an extra ticket, so I bought his ticket. So it'll be me and Jeff and I believe two of his brothers. But I'm driving up to Indianapolis by myself. I'm going to hang out with Jeff, and then we're going to come tailgate with you guys. And then after the concert's over, I'm going to go stay the night with my son. Then I'm going to spend the afternoon with him Sunday afternoon and then drive home Sunday evening.
Okay.
Cool.
Driving. We're actually driving back. We're actually going to go. Because the thing is, man, with Indianapolis, you know, they have that 11 o'clock curfew, which is 10 o'clock my time. I can be actually home by 1:30, you know, 1 or 1:30 easily. And it's just silly for me to have to
buy
a room.
I'll be in my bed asleep by the time you...
I know you will.
Yeah.
By the time I get my first coffee at the other side of Indianapolis.
It takes me now. I mean, it's an hour and 15, an hour and a half.
I'll be a Crane. I'll be a Crane by then, or Bloomington.
Be all right.
But anyway, so speaking of Ruhoff.
Speaking of Ruhoff, I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, speaking of Ruhoff,
go ahead.
We were actually just, Alan and I were actually just there this last previous Saturday to see the incredible Iron Maiden. It's been, Kelly and I sit down and we discussed it. It's been since 1985 since we saw Iron Maiden, and that was in Evansville, Indiana at Mesker during the Power Slave tour. It was Why on Earth except and Iron Maiden. And to me, that was actually, it's in my top shows, that show right there, the Power Slave, was in the top three. So what
I
do you
remember
think?
It. I don't remember it that well, but I remember it.
I wish I
went Saturday night, but we had other plans, and I had planned on going, but I missed it. My bad.
So I've been bugging Alan all week. I've been poking the bear, and I'm like going, dude, I go, what do you think of it? It was good, and that's all he'll tell me about. So Alan, what did you think about you're
muted.
You're muted, dumb shit.
I wasn't muted. I was death.
All right.
Yeah,
so give me your,
even
your,
at band practice last night, Dennis was like, okay, can you tell me now? And I'm like, it was
like
good.
A kid. You mean the guy that 15 minutes after we record an episode, he goes, when's it going to be up?
Yeah.
Do you have it rendered yet? What's going on?
Yeah, that's pretty funny. It was pretty funny the first 100 episodes.
Yeah.
No, it was pretty funny about the first.
I don't do it anymore, though.
But anyway... I thought the Iron Maiden concert was great. I'm just a casual fan. I have the CD Best of the Beast, and that's more than enough for me. While I think that it was a great concert, you know, my favorite part of the concert, concert-wise itself, was when Eddie came out as the trooper and did the sword fight with Bruce Dickinson and goofed off with the band. It was a great show. I probably won't go see them again. My second favorite part of the show was the guy to the right of us who had a meltdown because he found out that Andrew Luck had retired from football. I mean, this was a grown man. You know, he had to at least have been 25 years old. And he threw a temper tantrum like a damn toddler. And I honestly thought he was going to start crying. And I wish I had have had the forethought to get my phone out and record that. Because I'm pretty sure I'd have me a viral internet video.
Damn.
No, it was like I said, man. we ended up getting those reserved lawn seats, which put you basically center front in the lawn in a roped off area. You had to get a you get an extra ticket, and then they put a band on you so that way you could walk in and out. You didn't have to show your ticket every time. It was really nice, though. There were so many seats in there. It's not packed. You could sit down, and you're so close. You didn't have to, if the people in front of you were sitting, you didn't even have to stand up if you didn't want to. So it was nice, you know, that kind of deal. It was, musically-wise, it was perfect. Bruce Dickinson, at times, wasn't perfect, but he made up for it for his energy. I mean, there was only, like, a couple notes that he couldn't hit, but, I mean, the rest of the night,
you had to be listening to find his mistakes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm, you know, like I said, I'm more than a casual fan. I'm not a huge fan, but I'm more than a casual fan. I know. Yeah. The thing was, is they got to that middle part. There were three songs. I think it was right after the Klansman. There were three songs in there that were from some of those songs.
With the C, not a K.
Right. He made sure it said the Klansman with the C. But there were three songs in there in the middle that I really weren't familiar with, but it was kind of nice to get a break. I took a piss, you know, sit down for a minute, just kind of got my shit back together, and then the end. But, I mean, he even said, he goes, tonight we're not playing any new stuff. This is basically, you know, the legacy of the Beast.
Yeah.
So we're going to be playing all these good songs. And, you know, they come out with that airplane at the very beginning. And then later on during Flight of Icarus, they have this big inflatable kind of winged, you know, person flying toward it. You know, and he's up there with these fucking flamethrowers. And this, I mean, he's just blowing these flames out and shit. Then during Number of the Beast, they have this big inflatable head beast that comes up.
Thing was really graphically awesome. Detailed. It was fucking awesome.
It was awesome. Yeah.
One thing I did want to say about the concert, I hear a lot of people, and I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name, but I think it's Janik Jurs. I hear so many people give him a hard time for his, you know, his flamboyant antics on stage. You know, who gives a shit? It's a show. Yeah.
But one thing Bill would
like about the show was there was no drum solo and no guitar solo.
Yeah. Well.
Yes.
Not really, because there are extended solos in all the songs.
Well, those instrumentals, you know? That's all they are solos.
Yeah,
but, there wasn't just one specific person on the stage noodling.
Yeah.
But the thing was that having that guy, I know who you're talking about, the jerk, whatever his name is, having him in the band actually helps out, because when you do have Murray and Smith doing their double leads, you got a guy chunking off to the side, going, chunk, 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 you know, doing that, kind of filling in that rhythm. Yeah. And I like that. I mean, I like that part. Here's something really funny, just real quick from the show. There's two things real quick. As we're walking up from Sleepy Bear Campground, we get to the bottom of the hill. You know, you kind of walk up, start the cattle walk up to the metal detectors. We're sitting here, and this black Navigator drives up. And the back window goes down, and there's Nico. He's sitting in there. He's just kind of looking around. I looked at Kelly and go, hey, look, there's Nico and McBrain. He's like, he drove off. She goes, you are just so jaded now with this podcast. You meet all these people and says, you don't even get excited anymore. So you didn't take your camera out and anything. I was like, well, I really didn't think about it. I was like, going, hey, look, there's Nico. Hey, how you doing?
You know, you should have slipped him a card, you bastard.
Well, I should have. Well, if I ran toward the vehicle, I probably got tackled by somebody.
Yeah. Well, that would have been something worth watching.
Yeah.
One thing, notice, I wore this shirt to this concert. Guess who was the only guy at a Iron Maiden concert with a red shirt? Me. Everybody else was wearing
a black shirt. Now, I will say something. The difference between a Kiss concert and an Iron Maiden concert, non-musically, is an Iron Maiden concert is pretty much a sausage fest.
Exactly.
there were very few women there compared to the number of men.
I'm telling you what, dude. The number of drunk old people at that concert was unfucking real. And Alan's shaking his head right now. I don't know how much booze they sold that night, but it had to be a record.
You know, I bought one Yingling, and they were 24 ounces, and that was $14 and a quarter. You know,
well,
if you got drunk, you know,
yeah,
it cost you $1 million.
Spent $50 at least on three beers.
Yeah.
I got Kelly one of those Smirnoff peach and mango things, $16. One of those things. So anyway, on the way out, we get out, we leave. Okay, the last song comes on. I know what song it is. I told her, I said, I know we can hear it all the way to Sleepy Bear. I just want to get on the road because these drunk motherfuckers are, when they start getting out, I don't want to be anywhere close to this area on the road with these drunk people. So we started out, and as we're walking up there, people falling down. We get out to the front, back to where Nico was, and this dude is with his buddy. Well, they're about my, you know, they're all right. They're in their 50s, probably. They're going back to the Sleepy Bear campground also. This dude falls down on the street, right in the middle of the street. The cop gets out of the car, and he looks over, and he goes, I didn't even hear. He goes, yeah, his buddy's got him. We're not even going to mess with him. You know, we're not even going to dick with him. So he's got his buddy up, and we're walking on the right-hand side of that side road, you know, that goes back toward the main road. He's on the left side, and his buddy, he's got him by the back of the shirt, okay? And the drunk buddy's leaning forward the whole time, and he's, like, trying to run. So his buddy's talking to him like a dog. He's, like, going, you want to run, don't you? You want to run, don't you? He's, like, Kelly looks at me, and she goes, why are you not fucking taping this? And I'm like going, oh, shit. So I got my phone out. I'm trying to just nonchalantly kind of do this as we're walking along. And then he finally head plants down, and I'm like, oh, so I hit it. So ended up what happened was is I didn't hit the actual record button until after he had already fell down when I was
You're
trying to shut it off.
You're
so
an
I'm
idiot.
An idiot. So it would have been the greatest video ever.
Oh, man.
But this guy, he was like going, dude, he goes, it's only about a half mile. You can make it. I'm like going, he's going to have to carry this motherfucker all the way back to the campground.
All right. I got one last thing that I want to say
regarding
the Iron Maiden concert. I want to give a shout out to a kid named Soren Laufer. He went to high school with my son, and he and I actually went to the concert together because I got my ticket from him. And I appreciate him inviting me to the concert. And next time you want to go to another concert, give me a holler. We'll take us another trip, buddy.
Good deal.
Cool, man.
Like I said, you were right behind us. I saw you up there. You were standing kind of behind that reserve area.
Yeah, it was kind of hard to miss the guy in the blue shirt and the red hat.
you were the only other guy.
I told you that I was dead center in front of that four, and that's where I plan to be for the KISS concert, too. And I'll probably have the same red hat on.
Yeah, it was a good time had by all. And actually, I was telling you about as far as liking it as much as I did the first one. I honestly, my top five concerts, that was probably number three. And it goes Iron Maiden, Kiss Revenge, and this last Iron Maiden concert. It's probably third. And wow. I would say Alice Cooper's probably fourth after that. The one he played the whole Nightmare. It was that good. I mean, it was just absolutely. Yeah, you missed the bill. You should have took Lisa. Lisa would have loved it.
No.
One of my top concerts actually was 3 years ago yesterday, and we are recording this. Today is August 28th. I took my dad to see John Fogerty here in Evansville. Uh-huh. You know, that Facebook memory popped up yesterday, and I kind of got a little emotional about that. So
that's cool, man.
Yeah, but
it was a good memory for you.
That was a good memory. It was a good concert. My dad had been in the hospital, so I honestly didn't think he was going. I had one of my fishing buddies. I'm like, you're on standby in case Dad can't make it. I'm not wasting this ticket.
Exactly.
Anybody got anything else before we have our guest on?
I think we're good, man. Let's talk to Kyle.
All righty. We are starting our interview, our conversation, actually, we don't do interviews here, with Kyle Krueger from the Here I Go Again DVD. You know, I come across this. This is one of these things, and you'll be interested to know, you know, how your people find this disc. But I was on Facebook one day and got a Facebook ad, and I seen this documentary, and I went, talking about the 80s, supposed to have all these bands featuring all these different bands, and it must be a documentary about the 80s. So I bought this. I had my wisdom teeth cut out, and it came in the day after I had my wisdom teeth cut out. So I'm sitting doing nothing, and I'm like, well, I'm going to watch this documentary about the 80s. And then I go, wait a minute. And I started watching it, and I'm like going, it's completely different than what I thought. And how fucking entertaining is it? I mean, I was like, I really, really, really enjoyed it. And that's when I told these guys, I said, you got to see this thing. This is extremely, it's different. It's great. It kind of reminded me of the Canadian version of Anvil. You know, that kind of situation. But you guys went a little bit farther than that. You know what I'm saying? As far as trying to figure out where you're going to go and how to do it. And it was a good situation. So, Kyle, very good to have you on. Let's talk.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here. I appreciate it. To your point, that was a big swerve. We had all of these arts from the 80s, and the promo you probably saw was an advertising for the actual DVD, the extras and stuff. We felt like that was a way to get people interested in this, and then once they kind of sunk their teeth into the movie, then it was just like they'd follow the story. And for the most part, it's true. There's been a couple of people who weren't real happy with the fact that things were presented in that way, but you know, we got to do what we got to do. So, but hey, I'm glad the Facebook advertising is working, and you're the one person who's actually responded to that, so that's good.
No, and like I said, it wasn't the fact of that I was disappointed. It was the fact of that I really didn't pay. I just kind of glanced over it. You know, I'm one of those casual buyers. I'm like, oh, that looks good. I think I'm going to buy that. I didn't really go into it. I don't even think I really even watched the video for very long. I was like, oh, this just looks cool. I'm going to get it. So it really wasn't like you said, a false advertisement or anything. It's just but like I said, once I got it, I go, well, I really, really like this. I think this is a cool story. So start from the beginning. When did this became, was this, I know that you were going to do this for yourself as, getting your old band back together, but was it going to be a documentary from the very beginning, or how did that work?
Yeah, I mean, to be completely honest, this was a film idea before it was a get back into the music business idea. My partner, Steve McClure, and I had already made a film under our own imprint and had been in the business in various degrees over the years. So we were actually in the last third of working on another film that was kind of a heavier subject. And as most filmmakers that I know do, they get to the point where they're working on it, they're starting to look ahead. So we wanted to do something that was going to be a little bit louder than the previous subject matter. As most great ideas are conjured, this happened on a bar stool one night, and it just kind of took off from there. But no, it wasn't. It wasn't something that we actually, this the movie that you saw is not what we set out to make, not by any stretch of the imagination. It's what we ended up with. Halfway through, we found out that we weren't going to be able to put that band together, and we're like, well, we're in it now, so now what, you know? And it just took a life of its own. We didn't intend to be that way, and it was not about, hey, I want to put the band together, let's make a movie about it. It's like, let's make a movie about us putting a band back together. So,
gotcha. So did the parts of the other artists and stuff like that, was that cut in after you found out you weren't going to have the band and stuff like, I mean, you couldn't get the band back together? Was it really just kind of all fluid and kind of really how the movie flowed?
We actually interviewed most of the artists before we even jumped into our story. And there was a reason for doing that. We had to grab them when they were available, when they were passing through town. And that caused us to not knowing what our story was going to be about. Really, we just asked a bunch of questions and hoped that we would cover, you know, the spectrum in the course of doing this. So we probably went, I think from the time we started shooting, it was about 2 years before we actually jumped into filming our actual story. We had laid down the groundwork with the other guys in the band, and then as an independently produced film, money became an issue. So, you know, we would work on it for a couple of weeks, take a couple of months off, work on it for a couple of weeks. And by the time, and not to jump too far ahead, but by the time we kind of had our shit together, the other guys weren't interested anymore. So, but yeah, the art, most of the artists came first, and then we peppered them throughout. Even after we made the film, we continued filming, getting endorsements and that type of thing. But yeah.
That's cool. It was really good. I watched it yesterday, actually. I watched it through through Amazon Prime. And yeah, I was very impressed. I mean, I started watching it at the beginning. I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. Kind of a, you know, a cool documentary. And then it really kind of intrigued me. I was like, okay, are they going to make it? I mean, it's like there was that thing of, come on. And I was like, nope. Another plan. It was like there always seemed to be that thing. So I think you guys did a great job with it. But so what, you know, what really have you? So have you and Steve just remained friends for this entire time? I mean, were you guys, I guess, not friends at one point in time, or was there a big space there, or because it seems like the other guys had gone off and you hadn't seen them for years and years and years. So
right. Well, Steve and I have known each other, actually this coming January it'll have been 40 years. And we've had periods throughout our life when he went to college and I was playing in a band at the time. So we had, you know, months where we didn't see each other. And then I moved to California in the late 80s, early 90s, and he would come out and visit. And then I moved back to Florida, and then he moved out to LA and I would go out and visit. And then I moved to LA, and then he moved to Denver, and then I'd come here to visit. So, I mean, our relationship for the most part has remained intact throughout all of those years. Even now, he lives in Florida, so, and I'm in Colorado.
Oh, huh.
Gotcha.
Cool.
Because Bill and I are kind of like that. You know, we were friends, you know, through college, and then there was a space of time. You know, we had a little bit of time where, you know, he moved off and, you know, started families, and we, you know, we started our family, and then, you know, then we started getting back together, and that's, you know, we seen each other about once a year, maybe for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, or once, actually it was there were years where we didn't see each other for about 10 years.
Right. But you drove by my house, like, because his wife's parents live like right around the corner from where I used to live. And like at Christmas time, you'd drive by, I'd be out in the yard raking leaves or some kind of shit on Thanksgiving or whatever. You'd be like, going, hey, what's up? You know, but no, I thought that was kind of a cool where you guys, you know, you had your friendship that lasted that long. But then these other guys. And then, so when you went to see these guys, I mean, in the movie, was it, I mean, it was one of those things you'd already contacted him and kind of did it and then filmed it after that fact, you know what I'm saying? Or was it kind of when you went there to film, they were still deciding and, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so from the time we had the initial conversations, I think Gordon, who was our lead guitar player, we filmed him first because we felt like he was going to be the hardest get. And then John, our bass player, we didn't know where he was, and we had an impossible time tracking him down. And then our drummer, Jeff, we called him and we filmed that phone call. But from the time we made first contact to the time we actually, with the exception of Gordon, but the time we actually got with those other guys, I mean, it was over a year, maybe longer. Wow. And, you know, life gets in the way. And things had completely changed for the both of them. And, you know, Gordon just decided that it was a bad idea. So we gave him too much time to think about it, basically. So, but, you know, we followed through and, you know, they just said no. And so it's like, okay, well, I guess we'll go do it then. We'll go do our own thing. And that's what we did.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I thought that aspect of it was pretty cool. It was, you know, it's interesting. So we've interviewed a bunch of people from the Nashville area or whatever, and you know, as you talk to them, Anthony Quarter is a great example from Tora Tora that talks about, you know, he's a guy with a family and he lives in the Nashville area and he has a band that they play, you know, Tora Tora plays X number of times a year, but otherwise he's a guy living a life and has a job. You know, it's you know, and it does happen. Those things happen. I mean, people, you know, the success only lasted for everybody so long. I mean, there are a few of those that lasted a lot longer. But, you know, as you know now, finding you don't see a lot of those guys touring anymore, and they have families and lives and things like that that they're doing. And if they want to get back together, it's a commitment, and it's going to change their lives that they're been used to for the last 30 years. So doing that sometimes is not really very easy.
So. Yeah. And you know, there's a reason why all of these bands, particularly from the 80s era, have suddenly kind of popped up again. And that's because they've had their families, they've pushed their kids out of the house, and now they're back to their own time. That's exactly what happened to me. I mean, the day my kid turned 18, I'm like, sayonara, and we jumped right into this film. But the majority of these guys that you're talking about don't tour because touring doesn't make sense anymore. It's too expensive. It's a crap shoot. So most of these guys do fly-ins on the weekends. They're weekend warriors. Yep. Even like bands like Warrant, a couple of those guys have day gigs. I mean, they play significant gigs still, but they don't tour per se. Then you look at bands like LA Guns and Faster Pussycat, and those guys are still touring. They jump in the van or the bus and they go out and do it, you know. And then you have a band like Keel that does a show every 3 years, you know. But the touring thing, unless you're like A-list, and by A-list, that's not the quality of music. That's really the level of success that those artists have found, whether it's Metallica or Poison or Def Leppard. You know, they could afford to have a career, keep it going, but a lot of their bands just weren't able to do that. And we found out the hard way that it's almost impossible. If it's hard for them, it's impossible for somebody like me.
Yeah, we were talking to a gentleman not long ago. He was a lead singer for a band called Pump 5 out of Southern California, and he said that they finally had a tour that they were able, a small, you know, a band out of the, like I said, out of Southern California, and they were starting a tour. They developed a tour and it ended up getting canceled, but they had bands that were buying onto their tour, and it really wasn't a, I mean, he said it's a tour, but he goes, it's not really a tour. You know, we've got like a string of shows, so you can call it a tour if you want, but you know, it was all in that Southern California area and a little bit out into Arizona and Nevada and stuff. But he said, you know, there were bands that were willing just to buy on to be able to say they've been on a tour, because you can't do that anymore. You know, you're in a club or you're going from a club to another club 3 weeks from now. It's just, you just don't have that continuity. And he was talking just about how difficult that is. And I guess the guys in Pump 5 have been around for a long, long time. And those guys have sold a lot of records and been on a lot of different things from back in the 80s and stuff. But, you know, they're just, you know, now that just doesn't work that way anymore. And, you know, we've had a ton of people on here talking about just, you know, how do you even sell a record anymore? How do you sell a, you know, it's damn near impossible. So the only way to make any money off anything is to try to get out and do a show. But then again, to your point, that's a challenge in and of itself.
Yeah. I mean, there is no magic pill at all. And, you're right about the record business, and I'm probably jumping the gun, but I'll go ahead and mention this. Gene Simmons, in a Rolling Stone interview a couple of years ago, said, and I'm paraphrasing, rock is dead and the fans killed it. And I'm working on a project that the subtext of that project is really my response to Gene Simmons. And I'll say this, he wasn't wrong, but he wasn't right. Presented it completely wrong. What's rock is not dead, the way we deliver it is dead. And the fans didn't intentionally kill anything. When they lose the stream, how they used to receive their music and their entertainment, when the stream dries up, well, you go looking for water elsewhere. So I think that's been the innate challenge of hard rock artists in particular. And if you go on streaming services such as Spotify, I challenge you to find a rock artist in the top 100. And that is because rock fans, a particular breed, they're cut a certain way. They just aren't down with the digital thing. It hasn't quite caught up yet. But they're also not buying anything. So they're not listening to anything new and what's coming out on digital, and they're not buying anything new. So what does that leave? Well, I'm just going to listen to what I already have, which is the kind of basis for this whole nostalgia trip. which is hurting music because there's not a lot of original music that's finding its way to the public's ears. And that's a sad fact. So once somebody can come up with a way to fix that, everything will be fine. Trust me, rock's not dead. It's not. Gene Simmons is wrong on that point. But we got to figure out a better way to deliver it to the people who would like to hear it.
And can you talk a little bit about your sponsorship from Peavey?
Yeah. So we knew we weren't going to be able to pay for this film out of our own pocket. We paid for a lot of it out of our own pocket. But when it came to we don't have gear. We don't have any of this stuff. How are we going to do this? And so I was pretty intent on finding somebody to sponsor us and to fix that. So I ended up connecting with this guy in LA who basically that's what he does, is he connects sponsors to projects or bands or events. And we knew we had a couple of artists that were in the film that were PV artists, and we figured maybe if we got a meeting with them and we dropped their name and kind of pitched the idea to them, that they'll bite. And my pitch to them was this: look, we're older guys. We've got expendable income. We're getting back into music. We think we're going to inspire other people to do the same thing. And when they see us playing your gear, they're going to know it's good quality and it's affordable. Makes sense. And they were like, okay. I mean, it was pretty much that easy. It made sense. And so he said, pick out what you want and we'll send it to you. So I made a long list of stuff you saw in the film. They sent us a pallet.
Whole shitload of stuff.
Yeah. It was amazing. I'm like, damn, I just give
it. And the thing is, I've been using PV since I was in high school. I'm 54 years old, and I still buy. I got a new PV Classic back in the corner. That shit is basically indestructible. Sounds great. It's rock ready. So that's some great stuff. I think he froze up. You froze up?
Yeah. I lost you there for a second.
Yeah, I lost you there. I think you're back.
Okay. The guy we connected with in LA, his name is Jim Houck. And he was the one who really opened the door for us. But it was Steve Blaze from a band called Lillian Axe, who has been a lifetime PV endorser. Or is it, endorsee, one of those. Anyway, so the fact that we had really become friendly with him, and we had already interviewed him twice for the film, he actually came with us to the PV factory. We got the tour, and he really kind of legitimized us in their eyes once we got face-to-face. And you know, we interviewed Hartley PV. Unfortunately, we couldn't really find a place for that in the film. But, you know, they took pretty good care of us up until right before we released the movie, and they had a leadership change, and the guy who brought us in was no longer there. So as you can imagine, the next guy said, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you do, and I don't care. Bye-bye. So to my knowledge, nobody from PD has seen the film.
Really? Wow.
Which I think a great job of placing their product. When we went into the studio with Ron Keel to record our record, I insisted that was the only amp used that was it. The acoustic guitars had to be composite acoustics because I promised PV that we would do that. And we did, and never heard anything from them. So, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like I said,
that's weird.
Thanks for the gear.
Yeah. Well, it was actually, though, like you said, it was a great placement, and you did them well, and, you know, there was nothing bad spoken about them. I mean, they should have ran with that. I mean, that's free advertisement for, not free advertisement, but it is good advertisement for them.
Well, not only that, but I don't know if you recall, a couple of years ago, that they were on that show, Undercover Boss.
Oh,
and the premise of that show is basically basically they find employees who have sad stories, and then the bosses come in and, you know, give them money or try to help them improve their lives. And, you know, the general undertone of everybody's story was they're afraid they're going to lose their job because of them, you know, outsourcing, the potential for them to outsource. And PV's thing has always been made in the USA, right? It's a Mississippi-based company made in the USA. They made the show, they put it in the can, and then those people lost their jobs afterwards. They ended up outsourcing a fair amount, as I understand it. I can't speak on that entirely, but they started outsourcing stuff to Japan and cut down, shut down part of their plant in Meridian.
Oh, geez.
This is what I understand. This is what I heard. Can't hold it to me, and I'm sure they probably won't appreciate me talking about it right now, but it's like, this film could have been damage control for them.
Yeah.
It really, if it were me, I would have used it, and you could have spun this around a number of different ways, but forest, trees, who right. knows, man.
Wow.
So. No, and like I said, and they've been, they've been, like you said, they always talked about their American company and what have you. And like I said, I've used their products for years and loved them. You know, it's just one of those things. Going when you mentioned Ron Keel, that is actually my favorite moment in the movie, because we've had Ron Keel on our show. We've met Ron Keel multiple times at the things. You know, I'm 6 foot, almost 6 foot three. Ron's taller than I am. He's a big old guy. And in that movie, you were trying to sing that vocal, and he just got up on you hard and was like going, I was like, I thought I just loved that part of the movie. And I mean, like, going, you know, I couldn't imagine what that'd be like. I don't know how frustrated you were at that point. It's like going, I can't do it. I can't do it. But Ron's up in your face going, you know what, motherfucker, you're going to do this thing now.
Yeah.
I think, and you know what? And the thing was, he pushed you to that point to do it. And that's what Ron does. I mean, Ron's had some, you know, he's had some luck in his life that's not been good, and he's had, you know, he's worked hard and did this shit, and I just thought that was a great moment in that movie. I was like, because I asked Bill today, because I knew Bill was watching it today. I was like, did you see the Ron Keel part? But
it was hard to miss.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and
it is a great moment.
Listen, Ron is one of the most smartest, intelligent people that I know, and
great guy.
He had a plan, this has never been corroborated, but he had a plan going into this whole recording session that he was going to put us through our paces like a boot camp, and that we were going to pain. Now, the first day that we get the hour late, number one, Steve and I had from us, Utah, not awesome. So being late didn't stick with the sensei. And then when we assumed that the basics were going to be done, because Ron had already rehearsed that with Warner, who played drums for us. He was the drummer from the classic lineup of The Cult, and we figured that was going to be done. But oh no, they put us in the same room. Put headphones on us, plugged our guitars into direct boxes, and we had to play along with less. And we just weren't prepared for that. We knew our parts inside and out, but we weren't prepared for that dynamic. Steve, my partner Steve, had never, ever recorded anything in a studio before, and it had been years, at least 20, since I had done anything. But it took us way longer than it should have. It probably took us 10 hours to record 3 drum tracks, but he did it for a reason. And he really put us through our paces. And then as we went through, and started laying down our stuff, especially our guitar stuff, that went by fast. We knew our parts. There was no messing around there. And after we had gone through that first day with him, we're like, oh, we're not going to fuck around with this one. There's no way. By the time we got to the vocal sessions that you're talking about, it was the last day. We were leaving the following, and we had to drive 3 hours back to Vegas. We to record essentially all the vocals. So I was in the book nonstop. I think I took a 5-minute break to eat one time, but for it was close to 10 hours. I mean, I laid down everything that I could, and how I kept my voice, I have no idea, but I pulled it off. But what you saw was like probably the last hour when I'm just like, no more, this is too hard. No more. It's just forget, you know? And he was like, no, you don't. That's not ever going to play this. And I'm glad that he did. A, it made for a good story, but it also made for a pretty decent record considering we'd never really done it collectively before. So.
Exactly. Cool. That is cool. No, like I said, I just think that the whole premise of the movie is really cool. And like I said, you know, Bill hasn't, but you know, myself and Alan, you know, we went through bands, you know, in our high school years through college, and you know, we wanted to make it big at some point, and you know, and then families came along and stuff like that. So this is for every person in the world that's ever been in a band, you know, through this time that wanted to make it big. I mean, and we're all sitting there like, you know, like you guys are the underdogs, and we're all like, come on, you know, please, you know, give you a break, you know. And I thought that was really cool, and it's a great movie for any musician to watch. I really like it. Like I said, I've told a shit ton of people about getting it, and I still haven't watched all the extras yet. I just watched the movie itself. I haven't sit down and watched the, what is it? Is there like 5 hours of extras, or yeah, 5 hours of bonus material?
Everything altogether it's over 5 hours actual. Wow. Actually, because there's actually some audio stuff on there that we don't even mention in any of the advertising. We drilled pretty deep, and you know, that DVD, I'm glad that you mentioned it. It was really, we designed it to be kind of our scrapbook that helped document our journey. And we did radio interviews leading up to that when we were looking for funding. We did all sorts of interviews. Like I said, we had all these great killer experiences, and we did our best to document every one of them, either videographically or photographically, and included those in that. But yeah, so there's like over 5 hours of stuff. If you have a chance, you might want to give a listen to the, you know, Steve and I did a commentary track on there.
Oh, that's cool. I never even thought about that. I'm going to check that out.
What was interesting about that for us is that the day that we recorded it also happened to be the night that we were debuting the film here in Denver to a sold out audience. So if the nerves weren't already bad enough to put a microphone in front of us and have us sit there and jaw jack about our movie was just a little bit of a painful endeavor for me, to the point of where I think I might have listened to that track one time. So I can't be held responsible for how that played out. I don't know. I'm just not going to go there. But yeah, so 5 hours of extras and the film available on that DVD. And I think that's a pretty good deal.
And like I said, I do have the DVD, and I do like the fact that you even personally signed and thanked me on my receipt. And then also got this little piece of swag, a little, almost like a small theater card, what they used to call them. And then I got this fucking metal sticker, which I think is really cool. And then I got the card, of course. So, you know, you get a little swag bag whenever you get this thing. So it was really kind of cool. I like that. I like to get a little bit of extras, and you went the extra way of signing most of the stuff. So that's really cool. And like I said, I've told people about this thing. It's one of those, it's kind of one of those hidden treasures that, you know, people's like, especially people who are musicians, you know, that maybe average Joe is not going to find it interesting or what have you. They may, and don't get me wrong, but musicians will fucking love this. I mean, cause it is a story of all of us basically, you know?
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we did it. I mean, we're not, there are some guys who took this way seriously and those are the guys who kind of troll us. You guys had no business doing this. This should have been about me. And it's like, well, go make a movie then, man. That wasn't the point. No, that happens though. I mean, I get that. We don't get a lot of trolls, but when I get trolled, that's usually what it's about. Like, you know, you guys are a bunch of hacks. I'm like, no shit. what
tell me something I don't know.
What didn't you understand about that? You know, I mean, we hadn't played. Steve hadn't picked up a guitar at that 20 point.
Years,
in 25,
he said. 20,
yeah. Over 25, almost 30.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I hadn't played in a band in 20 years. Certainly didn't, you know, outside of some drunken karaoke, hadn't done anything through the latter part of the 90s into the aughts, you know. So, of course it is. I mean, that wasn't the point. The point, I mean, who would have bought this if we would have gone in there and killed it?
Right.
I mean, you know, that's there's nothing genuine about that. We genuinely could not play when we started making this movie. And we gradually reacquired a skill set to the best of our abilities. And, you know, we went after and closed a chapter that had been open for 25 years. And not a lot of people get to do that. And I ask that question often. You know, if you could go back in time and do it all over again, would you? And right. What price would you pay to do it?
Right.
And trust me when I tell you, the price we paid to go back and do that was hefty. Our lives have definitely changed for the better. They've also changed for the worse. But yeah, we sucked going in. I walked away a better musician. I walked away, you know, I rediscovered my songwriting skills.
Sure.
And I kind of legitimized myself to the point of where I rediscovered that huge part of me that was missing. And so now I'm playing music again. And now I feel like I'm kind of whole. So there's way more to this than going out there and being shredders and you know, that wasn't the point of this. The point was right. to go after something that escaped us, just to give it one last shot, as we say. And we did it. And I'm proud that we did it. And you're right. We represent a lot of people. I've gotten a lot of feedback on social media by way of email of guys who said, I watched this thing and I went out and I bought a guitar and now I'm playing again. And I know there are two bands in the last couple of years that guys who made it to the dance had some success, who told me that part of the reason they were inspired to get back together was after they saw this film.
That's good.
Okay. Then mission accomplished. We did it. To that end, we also designed this film in a way that you don't have to know the bands. You don't really have to be familiar with the music because it's a universal story. It doesn't matter if you were a musician or you were a ball player or you were a ballerina, or maybe you set out to go to college, life got in the way, and then during your midlife, you've decided to kind of reboot. That's what this is about. It's the music and everything, as wonderful as it is, and as important to us as kind of the soundtrack of our youth, is the backdrop.
Right.
And the experience that we got out of this has, like I said, it's been more amazing than not, but still the not has been significant too.
Right.
No, I mean, the guys that decided not to go forward, Gordon and the other guys, they've seen the film by now, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
So do they regret not being part of it? I mean, more of a part of it or not pushing through and doing it?
No one has verbalized that.
Okay.
We touched on that towards the third act of the film when we went to Gordon. Mm-hmm. We played the demo for him. And, you know, he's like, I'm surprised he got that kind of performance out of you. but when we said, if you knew this was the way it was going to go, would you have done it? And he was just, you know, no, you know, he still wouldn't have done it. I mean, that was just Gordon, and I love him like a brother. But he just stylistically, it's not something he wanted to do. He didn't want to do it. And that was it. The other guys, I remember talking to John. I think it might have been on Facebook or something. And we were just going back and forth. And I said, well, it's too bad you didn't want to do it. He goes, oh, wait a minute. I never said I didn't want to do it. It's like all of a sudden it's like the narrative changed a little bit with him. And it's like, okay. And then with Jeff, the drummer, he has come back a couple of times.
Yeah,
and said some real positive stuff to us. So I think that there's a part of him that wishes that maybe he did follow through.
So did his business.
You could tell that. You could tell that in the movie. I mean, the way you guys put that together. That's the thing. I was like, he's gonna come back. He's gonna come back. He's gonna come back. Nope, he didn't come back. But it really did. I mean, you could tell. I think he really wanted to come back.
Now, I mean, I was the one, I watched this.
Can you guys were in the car talking about that?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, he's coming back. Because
I watched this, like I said, after my wisdom tooth, so I was a little bit, I mean, I had a little sedation whenever I was watching this. The drummer is the one that he had the business started. He said, I can't do this. Now, he was so close to making it. Did his business take off?
Well, it was the combination of that and his wife. So there's a little story there. So when we reached out to him and said, hey, we want to come to North Carolina to film you, they had a vacation home. And so it's like this A-frame cabin, beautiful place. Sure. He offered this up to us, you know, and so we did some of the filming there. And then he took us around the town and we filmed. We found a beat up drum kit for him to jump on. Right. Well, it turns out he never told his wife that we were coming. And so she didn't know we were there.
I'm not surprised by that. You could just tell.
He wanted to play though. You could tell. He's like,
yeah,
I could do this.
Well, you can see in the first interview we did, he's like, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about doing a show? And then 3 days later, yeah, that's not such a great idea.
Because by the time he
talked to his wife, exactly.
We're all married. We know that. Yes. We know that.
Well, it's funny because you guys talked about that driving around. You were talking about that I heard him say yes. And then I think Steve might have went, no. What he said was, you know, he was real excited at the beginning and then it changed.
Right.
So, yeah, right. I mean, it was obvious. And I was like, I just thought it.
So to answer your question, that business, unfortunately, went belly up. And he's no longer married to that woman either. So.
Oh, really?
Damn.
Yeah. That's probably not a bad thing. I hope I'm not overstepping my boundaries by mentioning that. But, you know, it's unfortunate. I don't make light of that at all. I just think that he's probably thinking about the same thing that we were. It's like, I don't want to leave this planet wondering what if, you know, what if I would have done that? Now, with John, his story was a little bit different. His wife, and I don't recall how much we included in the film, but she wanted him to do this. She wanted him to do this badly. He was hung up is not the right word, but he was concerned because he just didn't want to leave his family for any length of time and was really devoted to his family, which is completely understandable.
Sure.
You know, but his wife was totally just like gung ho, like he's got to do this. He has to do this.
Right. And he was the bass player, correct?
He was.
Yeah. I remember her talking. You know, about how she was much. She liked listening to him play.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I don't listen. I don't fault any of these guys for not doing it. I mean, if I were, you know, if I would have been a little bit smarter, maybe I wouldn't have done it either. You know, it definitely turned my life on its ear. But I don't blame
the other guy too. Though he had this issues about being on stage and stuff, but he was in another metal band, right?
Well, yes and no. So he was he actually has a record deal for, he's in a 2-man death metal band. And I love the way that sounds. It's very,
that is
very poetic.
That's cool.
So they make all of their records at his house and then they send them to the record company. They release them. They don't play live. That's not his thing.
So he's not a live person. Gotcha.
Okay. No. But let me, you know, just talking a little bit about Gordon, when we were back in, when we had our band in the 80s, he was a little bit older than us, just like by a couple of years. That guy was so fucking good, though. It was ridiculous how good of a guitar player he was. And I don't think that he realized it. He was just, that was the main reason why I wanted to do this, was to get back together with him, see if it would spark anything. And unfortunately, it didn't happen. But I do not blame one of those guys at all for not taking the step forward. The conditions weren't right. And to tell you the truth, here's the way the film was supposed to go. Those guys said yes. We were going to raise the funding to go down to Florida where this band was formed. All of us had left. None of us, except for Gordon, was still living in the Bay Area in Tampa. We were going to rent a compound. We were going to live there and rehearse there and record there for 30 days and 30 nights and see if we couldn't walk out as a rock and roll band. We were going to have static cameras all over the place. So it was kind of like
Big Brother.
Big Brother.
Exactly.
In a way. And instead of like recording a record, we were going to have an engineer in the house all the time, just doing, you know, flipping the switch and then editing stuff as we go to see if we could walk out of there with at least a demo. And then we're going to finish up with the big show. We're going to bring all our family and friends in for a big show. I actually had the show arranged before I had any of this arranged. And it just fell through. We just could not pull it together. And, you know, for John's part especially, and Jeff, you know, we were asking them to leave their families for 30 days. So while we were negotiating with them to that end, we said, well, what if we get a place where it's a large enough property that the families can stay there and you can be with your family at night, and then you're with the band during the day and whenever we need you, and they're close by. And we, to be honest with you, we haggled over that. We made him an offer. We put it in an envelope and we said, we'll see you tomorrow. And we came back and he's like, yeah, this isn't going to work. So we offered to pay those guys and everything. I wasn't sure how we were going to get the money, but
I was like, I remember there being some financial difficulties.
Yes. Even in one shot, you see him, he's talking to us. He's holding the envelope that had our offer in it.
Wow.
And like I said, he had to do what he had to do, and I don't blame him at all. And that's when, that's when the plot thickened, as they say. And we went off on this amazing journey, this amazing tangent that just took us to places we never thought we'd go, to play with musicians we never thought we'd get to play with. For me personally, I was not happy with the gig that we ended up doing. I wanted something bigger, better, and badder. And we ended up having to settle for it because we were so far into the process. Steve was like, we got to finish this thing. Somebody's affording us an opportunity. We should go for it. And we did. But, right. You know, that was definitely not my, it was a great gig. Don't get me wrong. And the guys who set it up for us were fantastic, but it just was not, the gig I wanted. The gig I wanted was the main stage on the Monsters of Rock cruise.
Right.
That's the gig I wanted.
And that's one thing you can tell with, like in the movie, you know, it's one thing you, at the very end, you were like going, I'm glad we got this gig, but this is not the one we wanted. But you get to see you guys perform and it's live. And I can tell now after talking to you, as far as like the time wise, you had to do that.
But, yeah. But the good news is we ended up playing on the Monsters of Rock cruise. It happened.
There you go.
So we accepted this gig. The gig was that we were going to be the feature act in front of Jakey Lee's band, Red Dragon Cartel, Jakey Lee from Ozzy Osbourne's band. And we ended up having to call together players from Denver in order to pull this show off. And right as we started rehearsing, we get the call from the Monsters of Rock crews. Hey, if you guys want to do this thing, bring it. Well, We couldn't afford to bring this new band with us. We, to be honest with you, I think we had rehearsed like three times, so that wasn't going to work. So we ended up calling Ron Keel, whose band was playing on the cruise. Said, "Do you want to play?" He's like, "Absolutely." We called Steve Blaze from Lillian Axe, who was playing on the cruise. "Do you want to play?" He's like, "Absolutely." And then a buddy of mine from Tampa, who's a drummer, who just happened to be going. His name is Chris Kinder. I asked him and he's like, sure. So you saw a brief shot of us getting together in a cabin to rehearse. That was our only rehearsal.
Wow.
And so we got to the point where we were only going to do one song. Because we didn't have the chance to rehearse and we wanted to capture it for posterity.
Right.
And we get out there. Keel played before us, so Keel kind of, that band opened for us. And Ron got on the mic. He made everybody stay in the room. We had a full room. We got up to do the show, and halfway through the song, I can't hear my vocals anymore, and so I just kept motoring through, just kept playing until the song was done. Until one of the camera guys go, "Yeah, the PA went out halfway through. You're gonna have to do it again." I'm like, and what had happened was, is that when they go over the loudspeaker on a cruise boat to make announcements and such, it cancels out they have it scheduled so there's not supposed to be anybody playing at that time. And so right. it automatically cancels out. It powered us down. It's a safety precaution. In the event that sure. you know there's some sort of duress on board, you know, boom, everything shuts down. And that's what happened to us. So we ended up playing the song twice. And Spinal Tap, man. Wouldn't have had it any other way.
Is it better the second time or the first time?
It was better the first time.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. Damn it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just everybody hit their cues and every, you know. And I had to, when we did it the second time around, there were some missed cues. So, and you didn't see it because we didn't include that part of it. But I kind of was like looking around everybody and I was just like, follow my lead, guys. And so we kind of played through a little bit. And then, you know, I just kind of looked at everybody. We came back in and we pulled it off. So, but, you know, I there's not a lot of people on this planet who can say Ron Keel was their bass player, man.
Yeah, no shit.
So, that's cool.
He's a great guy too.
Hey, before you get off here, I got a question for you. So, sure. In the beginning of the video, they talk about 300 shirts, and I see you got a couple back there. So, do you get shirts at every show you go to, or what's the collection from? How old are they?
I have some that are probably 30 years old. But to be honest with you, I went and bought them used. Like on eBay and stuff like that. My stuff from the 80s did not survive. And you know what? It would probably come up to here. I'm going to be a midriff anyway.
That's the same for all of us.
We have the same problem.
Yes. So for me, it was, I mean, yeah, if you understand the psychology behind merch at concerts, it's people, that's how they document a positive experience.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Sure. Hard Rock Cafe has built a business based on that very thing. In fact, Hard Rock is a t-shirt shop that has a restaurant attached to it. And if you shut down the t-shirt shop, you could write on the calendar when all of the restaurants would close. And I know that because I used to work for them. But so I'm one of those people. I want to document a positive experience.
Sure.
And I do that by purchasing merch. But that's not limited to big shows. I try to support local bands, and so I do that. Now my collection's up; it's closer to 500 now, because when we filmed that was quite a while ago. And a lot of those, you can imagine, there were some perks after making this film where people would send me stuff, hoping I'd wear it on camera, and you know that kind of thing. So what you see behind me, though, that's actually our merch.
Yeah, yeah,
cool. We have. From the very beginning, we treated this film like it was a band, and we created merch for it, and we got everything from guitar picks and that kind of stuff. And again, it's one of those things that you can only buy the movie once, and we found that people were so invested in what we were doing that, well, here's another way that you can support us and show your, you know, your team spirit. And so we created all of these t-shirts. We've got a great designer here in Denver. Her name's Brooke McKay of Vamp Visuals, and she designs everything, from the posters to the DVD cover to all of our t-shirts. She did everything. She did a fantastic job. And so that was inspired by my own personal trip of always having to buy a shirt whenever I go to a show. Always.
Cool, man.
So as far as that's concerned, as far as your merch, where can we find your merch? Where can we find the movie? Where can we find everything? Here we go again. There we go. Puppy.com.
Yeah, it's actually hairigoigo.com.
Hair I go. What did I say?
Yeah.
Did I say here?
Hair we go again will be a sequel. hairigoigo.com is the place to get that. But people are going to have to be pretty fleet about picking up their stuff because ironically, as of this past weekend, we decided to close down the business. We feel like that the film has run its course. We've done the best that we can with it. And unfortunately, it's so expensive to run day to day. We just don't have the means. We have production loans that still have to be paid. And, you know, there's a reason why it's not on Netflix, because you have to pay an aggregator to pitch it to Netflix, and it's thousands upon thousands of dollars. We weren't able to take it internationally because everybody, all the buyers for the different territories required that there be captioning in those languages. And I don't know if you know how expensive it is to caption in Japanese, but it's about $500 a minute. So we got to the point where I think we've done as much as we can with this. So as of January 1st, unless something amazing happens, January 1st will probably be it for us, which sucks because I actually had two other projects that were Here I Go Again projects that were already in production. One was, it's kind of like the DVD extras, but we put them in more of a narrative format. And then a second volume, which picks up after the movie stopped, you know, talking about some of the experiences that we had both as filmmakers and musicians. And these were inspired by the filmmaker Q&As that we did when we took the film out and screened it. And we said, you know, instead of telling them, why don't we show them? We've got so much footage. So we started on that process. I've even gotten as far as developing a treatment for a sequel. I wasn't kidding. that isn't about Steve or myself, but going back to the first movie and plucking a couple of those name guys and taking a look at their reinvention 30, 35 years later and the varying degrees of success and failure. And the part of the subtext of that film was, as I mentioned before, my answer to Gene Simmons on his claim that rock is dead, the fans killed it. And I really wanted to do something that was that felt it had a little bit more of an expose feeling to it. And I just to peel the curtain back to let people understand that the whole rock star thing is a myth. It's mythology. It's not real. These guys are regular people. And most of them live hand to mouth still, you know, trying to forge a living with their art. And I think it's important that people see that, because I think if people see that and they understand it, they'll understand how important it is for them to support these artists by purchasing, you know, their music and their merch or whatever, because there's only one way you can properly thank an artist, and that's by paying for their stuff and whenever possible, buying it directly. When you are listening to Spotify or you're listening to a streaming service, the artist is being disserviced because it's the record label who's making all the money off of that stuff. They still own the rights to it years and years later. And the only way that these artists have the only opportunity they have to make money is by doing these shows, whatever merch, and then releasing their own records. And I got to tell you, man, Ron Keel's Bad Keel, they put their best record out. The last record they did was the very best Streets of Rock and Roll. Really hands good. Down, the best Keel record ever. I have all the Keel records. I was a huge Keel fan in the 80s. And they had huge hits. The Right to Rock, Somebody's Waiting. I'm telling you, the Streets of Rock and Roll, followed by Metal Cowboy, followed by the newest Ron Keel band record, is eons above and away from what they did originally. So much better. It's ridiculous. And it stands to reason. These guys were in their 20s when they were making their initial records. A lot of their stuff was, you know, because of their producer. Gene Simmons produced two Keel records, right? You think in 30 years, these guys have probably learned a thing or two and could probably write a decent song. And you would think, well, I bet you they could write a better song than when they were 20. You know, right. And people need to realize that there's a lot of great music. These artists are still making music, and you got to support it. Otherwise, that's when it goes away. Yeah. And I'm just, you know, I made a movie about nostalgia, and I'm not the most nostalgic person, believe it or not. And I'm really not. Right. I'm waving the flag for new music, for new artists, whether they're classic artists who are releasing new stuff or they're brand new artists. We need new music, and the old stuff is fantastic. I love it. Soundtrack of my youth. But I don't want to hear "You Shook Me All Night Long" ever again. I know it by heart. It's good. Give me something new.
You're repeating Dennis word for word.
Well, and the whole thing is, and we'll end it with here, like I said, and we appreciate you coming on, but the whole point is rock is not dead. You just got to know where to find it. And because these people that are putting out great tunes are not on mainstream radio, they've got them out, and you got to find them. And this show has helped us. And we every time we find somebody, we promote the shit out of them because they got to be able to find it. But anyway, Kyle, we thank you so much for being on tonight, brother. And like I said, go out and check out, buy this movie while you can. Here I go again, not we go again. Sorry about that. I'm a faux pas guy. But anyway, we're glad to have you on. Stay around for just a second. Alan, why don't you take us out, brother?
Visit us on agesofrock.com. Check us out on Stitcher Radio and now on iHeartRadio. You can also find our social media there. Till next week. Let me find the right button here. I'm on the wrong screen. Peace out, folks. Thanks for listening to the Ages of Rock podcast. If you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, and most importantly, tell all your friends. Remember, you're never too old to rock. Until the next episode, peace out, folks.